You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to the fifth and final session in our series of CEU lectures. I'm John Shattuck, President and Rector of Central European University. We're starting just a little bit late, so we will go a little bit longer beyond 3 o'clock. I'm sure you'll all agree that this has been an extraordinary week. And it's been my great privilege over the course of the week to host these path-breaking lectures by George Soros, held here in Budapest at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences under the auspices of Central European University. Today, we have reached the grand finale. Never one to shrink from controversy or prediction, today George Soros will bring together the themes he has been exploring throughout the week and turn his attention to the future. He will outline key global trends and discuss their economic and political implications as he sees them for the years ahead, focusing in particular on the increasingly important role that China is likely to play on the world stage. As we've done throughout the week, we're expanding our audience today far beyond Budapest and are including students, appropriately, from China, from Hong Kong University. This will complete our unprecedented three-continent, five-university global outreach to students who are participating in these lectures through interactive video conferencing in real time. Our moderator for this lecture is Howard Davies, director of one of the world's great universities, the London School of Economics and Political Science, whose students were part of our global audience on Monday. We also have a distinguished former international leader here in the front row who will offer a brief commentary from the floor, Cristóvão Buarque, a Brazilian senator and former candidate for president. Mr. Soros will speak for approximately 50 minutes, following which Mr. Davies will briefly comment. Mr. Soros will then take questions, starting with three questions from Hong Kong and then more questions from the audience here in Budapest. And now, to deliver his fifth and final lecture, I'm delighted once again to introduce George Soros, who will take us into the future with a grand summation of his thinking about our world.
Thank you. In these lectures, I've offered a conceptual framework for a better understanding of human events. These events are not determined by timelessly valid scientific laws. Such laws exist, of course, but they are not sufficient to determine the course of events. The complexity of the situations is one reason, and the role of the participants' thinking is another. I have focused on the reflexive two-way connection between the participants' thinking and reality, and I emphasized the causal role that misunderstandings and misconceptions play in shaping reality. But these influences have been strangely ignored. They introduce an element of uncertainty into the subject matter, which, except in the simplest situations, make it impossible to predict the future. One can still sketch various plausible scenarios and evaluate their likelihood. One can also prescribe desirable outcomes. I've done both many times. Indeed, I can claim to be a specialist in it, focusing on predictions as an investor and prescriptions as a philanthropist. I've been successful enough in the former to be able to afford the latter. I should like to devote today's discussion to this dual task. We are at a moment in which the range of uncertainties is unusually wide. We've just passed through the worst financial crisis since World War II. is quantitatively much larger and qualitatively different from other financial crises. The only relevant comparisons are with the Japanese real estate bubble, which burst in 1991 and from which Japan has still not recovered, and with the Great Depression of the 1930s. What differentiates this crisis from the Japanese experience is that the latter was confined to a single country, while this crisis has involved the entire world. What differentiates it from the Great Depression is that this time the financial system was not allowed to collapse, but was put on artificial life support. In fact, the magnitude of the credit and leverage problem we have today is even greater than in the 1930s. In 1929, a total credit outstanding in the United States was 160% of GDP, and it rose to 250% by 1932. In 2008, we started at 365%, and this calculation doesn't take into account the pervasive use of derivatives, which was absent in the 1930s. And yet, in spite of that, the artificial life support has been successful. Barely a year after the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, financial markets have stabilized, stock markets have rebounded, and the economy is showing signs of recovery. People want to return to business as usual and think of the crash of 2008 as a bad dream. I regret to tell you that the recovery is liable to run out of steam and may even be followed by a double dip, although I'm not sure whether it will be in 2010 or 2011. My views are far from unique, but they are at variance with the prevailing mood. The longer the turnaround lasts, the more people will come to believe in it, but in my judgment, the prevailing mood is far removed from reality. This is characteristic of far from equilibrium situations when perceptions tend to lag behind reality. To complicate matters, the lag works in both directions. Most people have not yet realized that this crisis is different from previous ones, that we are at the end of an era. Others, including me, failed to anticipate the extent of the rebound. The confusion is not confined to the financial sphere. It extends to the entire international arena. After the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the United States emerged as the sole superpower. No other power or combination of powers could challenge its supremacy. But the unipolar world didn't take root. When President Bush sought to assert America's supremacy by invading Iraq on false pretenses, he achieved the exact opposite of what he intended. The United States suffered a precipitous decline in its power and influence. So the disarray in the international financial system is matched by instability in international relations. The new order that will eventually emerge will not be dominated by the United States to the same extent as the old one. To understand what's happening, we need a different conceptual framework from the one to which we have become accustomed. The efficient market hypothesis looks at financial markets in isolation and totally disregards politics. But that gives a distorted picture. As I have pointed out several times, behind the invisible hand of markets, there is the visible hand of politics, which establishes the rules and conditions in which the market mechanism operates. My conceptual framework relates to the political economy, not the market economy as an abstract construct that is governed by timelessly valid laws. I look at financial markets as a branch of history. The international financial system, as it was reconstructed after the Second World War, didn't create a level playing field. It was lopsided by design. The international financial institutions, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, were organized as shareholding companies in which the rich countries held a disproportionate share of the votes and also controlled the boards. This put the countries at the periphery at a disadvantage vis-a-vis those at the center. Ever since, the system has been dominated by the United States. At the Bretton Woods Conference, Lord Keynes proposed, but it was the head of the American delegation, Harry White, who disposed. Since then, we have gone from an almost completely regulated system to an almost completely deregulated one. But the changes were led by the United States, and the system has continued to be guided by what has become known as the Washington Consensus. Although the rules laid down by the Washington Consensus are supposed to apply to all countries equally, the United States, as the issuer of the main international currency, is more equal than the others. Effectively, the international system has a two-tier structure. Countries that can borrow in their own currency constitute the center, and those whose borrowings are denominated in one of the hard currencies constitute the periphery. If individual countries get into difficulties, they receive assistance, but only on strict conditions. That holds true whether they are from the center or from the periphery. But if the center itself becomes endangered, then preserving the system takes precedence over all other considerations. That happened for the first time in the international banking crisis of 1982. If the debtor countries had been allowed to default, the banking system would have collapsed. Therefore, the international financial authorities banded together and introduced what I called at the time the collective system of lending. The lenders were induced to roll over their loans, and the debtor countries were lent enough additional money to service their debts. The net effect was that the debtor countries fell into severe recession. Latin America lost a decade of growth, but the banking system was allowed to earn its way out of a hole. When the banks built up sufficient reserves, the loans were restructured into so-called Brady bonds, and the banks wrote off their remaining losses. Something similar happened again in 1997. But by then, the banks had learned to securitize their loans so they couldn't be forced into a collective system of lending, and most of the losses had to be taken by the debtor countries. This set the pattern. The debtor countries were subjected to harsh market discipline, but when the system was in danger, the normal rules were suspended. Banks, whose collective failure would have endangered the system, were bailed out. The financial crisis of 2007-2008 was different because it originated at the center and the periphery countries were drawn into it only after the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. The IMF was faced with a novel task: to protect the periphery from a storm that originated at the center. It didn't have enough capital, but member countries banded together and raised $1 trillion. Even so, the IMF had some difficulties in coping with the situation because it was designed to deal with problems in the public sector, and the shortage of credit was impacting mainly the private sector. But on the whole, the IMF adapted itself to its novel task remarkably well. Overall, the international financial authorities have handled this crisis the same way as previous ones. They bailed out the failing institutions and applied monetary and fiscal stimulus. But this crisis was much bigger, and at first, the same techniques didn't work. The rescue of Lehman Brothers failed. That was a game-changing event. Financial markets actually ceased to function and had to be put on artificial life support. This meant that governments had to effectively guarantee that no other institution whose failure would endanger the system would be allowed to fail. That's when the crisis spread to the periphery, because periphery countries couldn't provide equally credible guarantees. This time it was Eastern Europe that was the worst hit. The countries at the center used the balance sheets of their central banks to pump money into the system and to guarantee the liabilities of commercial banks, and governments engaged in deficit financing to stimulate the economy on an unprecedented scale. And these measures have been successful, and the global economy appears to be stabilizing. There is a growing belief that the global financial system has once again escaped collapse, and we are slowly returning to business as usual. This, in my opinion, is a grave misinterpretation of the current situation. Humpty Dumpty can't be put together again. Let me explain why. The globalization of financial markets that took place since the 1980s was a market fundamentalist project spearheaded by the United States and the United Kingdom. Allowing financial capital to move around freely in the world made it difficult to tax it or to regulate it. This put financial capital in a privileged position. Governments had to pay more attention to the requirements of international capital than to the aspirations of their own people, because financial capital could move around more freely. So, as a market fundamentalist project, globalization was highly successful. Individual countries found it difficult to resist it. But the global financial system that emerged was fundamentally unstable, because it was built on the false premise that financial markets can be safely left to their own devices. That is why it broke down, and that's why it can't be put together again. Global markets need global regulations, but the regulations that are currently in force are rooted in the principle of national sovereignty. There are some international agreements, most notably the Basel Accords on minimal capital requirements, And there's also good cooperation among market regulators. But the source of the authority is always the sovereign state. This means that it's not enough to restart a mechanism that has stalled. We need to create a regulatory mechanism that has never existed. As things stand now, the financial system of each country is being sustained and supported by its own government. The governments are primarily concerned with their own economies. This tends to give rise to financial protectionism, which threatens to disrupt and perhaps destroy the global financial markets. British regulators will never again rely on Icelandic authorities, and countries at the periphery will be reluctant to be entirely dependent on foreign-owned banks. The point I'm trying to make is that regulations must be international in scope. Without it, financial markets can't remain global. They would be destroyed by regulatory arbitrage. Businesses would move to the countries where the regulatory climate is the most benign, and this would expose other countries to risks they can't afford to run. Globalization was so successful because it forced all countries to remove regulations, but the process doesn't work in reverse. It will be difficult to get countries to agree on uniform regulations. Different countries have different interests, which drive them towards different solutions. This can be seen in Europe. And if European countries can't agree among themselves, how can the rest of the world? During the crisis, Europe couldn't reach a Europe-wide agreement on guaranteeing the financial system. Each country had to guarantee its own. As things stand now, the euro is an incomplete currency. It has a common central bank, but it doesn't have a common treasury. And guaranteeing or injecting equity into banks is a treasury function. The crisis offered an opportunity to remedy this shortfall, but Germany stood in the way. Germany used to be the driving force behind European integration, but that was at a time when Germany was willing to pay practically any price for reunification. Today, Germany is very different. It's at odds with the rest of the world in fearing inflation rather than recession. And above all, it doesn't want to serve as the deep pocket for the rest of Europe. Without a driving force, European integration has ground to a halt. Fortunately, Europe had the benefit of the social safety net. It had held down European growth rates in good times, but it served its purpose in the downturn, and the recession in Euroland turned out to be less severe than expected. Now that the fears of an economic collapse have subsided, the European Union is showing some signs of political revival. For instance, the European Central Bank has effectively bailed out the Irish banking system, and Ireland has resoundingly endorsed the Lisbon Treaty. So perhaps I should not be so pessimistic about Europe. The fact that the financial crisis is having different long-term impacts on different countries may turn out to be more of a problem. In the short term, all countries were negatively affected, but in the long term, there will be winners and losers. Although the range of uncertainties for the actual course of events is very wide, shifts in relative positions can be predicted with greater certainty. To put it bluntly, the United States stands to lose the most, and China is poised to emerge as the greatest winner. The extent of the shift is already exceeding most expectations. There will be significant changes in the relative positions of other countries as well. But from a global perspective, the one between the United States and China is the most significant. The United States has been at the center of the international financial system ever since the Second World War. The dollar has served as the main international currency, and the United States has derived immense benefits from that position, but lately it has abused its privilege. Starting in the 1980s, it has built up an ever-increasing current account deficit. This could have continued indefinitely because the Asian tigers, first under the leadership of Japan and now of China, were willing to finance that deficit by building up their dollar holdings. But the excessive indebtedness of the United States households brought the process to an end. When the housing bubble burst, households found themselves overextended. The banking system has suffered tremendous losses and has to earn its way out of a hole. In commercial real estate and leveraged buyouts, the bloodletting is yet to come. These factors will continue to weigh on the American economy, and the American consumer will no longer be able to serve as the motor for the world economy. To some extent, China may be able to take its place. China has been the primary beneficiary of globalization, and it has been largely insulated from the financial crisis. For the West, and the United States in particular, the crisis was an internally generated event which led to the collapse of the financial system. For China, it was an external shock which has hurt exports, but left the financial, political, and economic system unscathed. China has discovered a remarkably efficient method of unleashing the creative, acquisitive, and entrepreneurial energies of the people, who are allowed to pursue their self-interest, while the state can cream off a significant portion of the surplus value of their labor by maintaining an undervalued currency and accumulating a trade surplus. So China is likely to emerge as the big winner. Now, China is not a democracy, and the rulers know that they must avoid social unrest if they want to remain the rulers. Therefore, they'll do anything in their power to maintain economic growth at 8% or more and create new jobs for a growing workforce. And they have plenty of power because of the trade surplus. China can stimulate its domestic economy through infrastructure investments, and it can foster its exports by investing in and extending credit to their trading partners. After all, that's what China was doing when it was financing its exports to America by buying U.S. government bonds. Now that the American consumers have to cut back, they can do the same with other countries. So China will be a positive force in the world economy, while the United States will be limping along. The Chinese economy is, of course, much smaller than the United States. With a smaller motor, the world economy is likely to move forward at a slower pace. But within these limits, a tectonic shift is taking place between the United States and China, with third parties reorienting themselves to the source of positive impulses. The shift may not be permanent or irreversible. Just think of the rise and fall of China Inc. But at the present moment, it constitutes the most predictable and significant trend in the global political economy. And China is pulling its trading partners like Brazil and some African and Asian countries along with it. India is also doing well based on domestic growth. The success of Chinese economic policy can't be taken for granted. The infrastructure investment in the Chinese hinterland may or may not generate self-sustaining economic growth. Under the Chinese system, the return on new investments is generally very low because investment decisions are dictated by political rather than commercial considerations. On the previous two occasions, the relaxation of bank credit has produced a spate of bad loans. This time it may be different because there has been a shift in power from the regional to the central authorities, and the local officials of the banks are no longer under the control of the local provincial authorities. But success can't be taken for granted. Moreover, China may be dragged down by a global slowdown. But if China flounders, the global economy loses its motor. Therefore, the relative success of China is more assured than its absolute success. We are at a moment in history which in some ways is comparable to the end of the Second World War. Then the prevailing system had actually collapsed and a new one had to be built from scratch. At Bretton Woods, the victorious powers proved equal to the task. Inspired mainly by Lord Keynes, they built a system that could accommodate the entire world, even if the United States was more equal than others. Now, the prevailing multilateral system, call it international capitalism, didn't fully collapse, but it has been greatly weakened, its inherent flaws have been revealed, and is challenged by a viable alternative. The rise of China offers a fundamentally different form of economic organization than the current international financial system. It may be given the label of state capitalism as distinct from the international capitalism championed by the Washington Consensus. We are at the end of an era, but we are not fully aware of it. The two forms of economic organization, state capitalism and international capitalism, are in competition with each other. Neither of them is attractive. The Washington Consensus has failed. International capitalism, in its present form, has proven itself inherently unstable because it lacks adequate regulation. It's also highly unjust because it favors the haves over the have-nots. At the same time, an international system based on state capitalism would inevitably lead to conflicts between states. The first sign of conflict are already beginning to surface because, ironically, China is repeating the mistakes of the colonial powers in dealing with the countries that are rich in natural resources, just at a time when the colonial powers have learned from their past mistakes and are trying to rectify them. In order to gain access to natural resources, China is dealing with the rulers and neglecting the people. This helps oppressive and corrupt regimes to stay in power. This is an undesirable outcome, but China is not the only one to be blamed for it. When a Chinese company tried to buy Unocal, the American oil company, it was rebuffed. And more recently, Rio Tinto reneged on a deal to sell an interest to a Chinese company. This has pushed China into dealing with those countries that the international financial institutions have shunned: Burma, Sudan, Zimbabwe, and the Congo, and Angola. They stand out. Guinea is the latest example, where there's been a riot with 150 people killed, and China has extended a loan of $7 billion. This is becoming a source of considerable friction, which is not in the best interests of China, let alone the rest of the world. But China considers itself the aggrieved party and remains reluctant to join the extractive industry's transparency initiative. This has become the biggest obstacle to the continued success of that initiative. While the prevailing multilateral system will try to reconstitute itself, China will expand on a bilateral basis. China is, of course, part of the multilateral system, but it doesn't occupy within that system a position that is commensurate with its current and anticipated prospective strength. Therefore, its participation in the international financial institutions is rather passive, and its active expansion is lying to go through bilateral challenge. For instance, China will complain about the role of the dollar and will promote the role of special drawing rights, but it's unlikely to allow the renminbi to become freely convertible, because that would destroy the mechanism that has allowed the state to harvest the fruits of cheap Chinese labor through an undervalued currency. China will continue to maintain capital controls, but will establish bilateral clearing accounts denominated in renminbi with countries like Brazil. This will diminish the status of the dollar as the international currency without actually replacing it. To sum up, the world is facing a choice between two fundamentally different forms of organization. We may label them international capitalism and state capitalism. The former, represented by the United States, has broken down, and the latter, represented by China, is in the ascendant. The path of least resistance leads to the gradual disintegration of the international financial system as we know it. Yet, a system of bilateral relations is liable to generate conflicts between states. A new multilateral system based on sounder principles needs to be invented. That would serve the best interests of both the United States and China, and of course, the rest of the world. Now, while international cooperation is almost impossible to achieve on a piecemeal basis, it may be attainable in a grand bargain where the entire financial order is rearranged. The emergence of the G20 as the primary forum of international cooperation and the peer review process adopted at the Pittsburgh meeting are steps in the right direction. But the G20 has to operate within the confines of the Articles of Association of the IMF as they are currently, because changing the articles is a long drawn out process. This is what a new Bretton Woods conference could accomplish in one fell swoop. It would reconstitute the IMF to better reflect the prevailing pecking order among states and revise its methods of operation. It would decide how to treat financial institutions that are too big to fail, and it would consider new rules to control capital movements, because the total freedom of financial capital to move around freely in the world has proved to be a source of instability and needs to be corrected. The use of the dollar as the main international currency has produced dangerous imbalances. The dollar is no longer enjoys the trust and confidence it once did. Yet, no other currency is in a position to take its place. There is a general flight from currencies into gold and other commodities and tangible assets. That's harmful because it keeps those assets out of productive use and stokes the fears of inflation. The United States ought not to shy away from the wider use of special drawing rights, SDRs. That should induce China to abandon its peg to the dollar, and that would be the best way to reduce international imbalances. Since SDRs are denominated in several national currencies, no single currency would enjoy an unfair advantage. The range of currencies included in the SDRs would have to be widened, and some of the newly added currencies, which would include the renminbi, may not be fully convertible. Therefore, the dollar could still re-establish itself as the preferred reserve currency, provided it's properly, prudently managed. One of the great advantages of SDRs is that they allow the international creation of money. That would be particularly useful at times like the present. The money could be directed to where it is most needed. That would be a great improvement over what's happening currently. A mechanism which would allow rich countries that don't need additional reserves to transfer their allocations to those who need them is readily available and has already been used on a small scale. The reorganization of the prevailing world order may have to extend beyond the financial system if we are to make progress in resolving issues like global warming and nuclear proliferation. It may have to involve the United Nations, especially the membership of the Security Council. This rather profound process needs to be initiated by the United States, but China and other developing countries ought to participate in it as equals. They are reluctant members of the Bretton Woods institutions, which are dominated by countries that are no longer dominant. The rising powers need to be present at the creation of the new order to ensure that they'll be active supporters of it. Now, why should the United States initiate changes in a system of which it had been the main beneficiary? Because the system can't survive in its present form, and the United States has more to lose if it is not in the forefront of reforming it. America lost a lot of power and influence during the Bush presidency. Without far-sighted leadership, the relative position of the United States is likely to continue eroding. The United States is still in a position to lead the world. It can no longer impose its will on others, as the Bush administration sought to do, but it could lead a cooperative effort which would involve not only the developed, but also the developing world. This would reestablish American leadership in an acceptable form. Now, why should China submit to a new multilateral system in view of the fact that it is set to emerge as the winner from the current turmoil? The answer is equally simple. In order to continue rising, it must make itself acceptable to the rest of the world. That means that it must move towards a more open society, combining an increased measure of individual freedom with the rule of law. Given the current military power relations, China can continue rising only in a peaceful environment where the rest of the world willingly accepts the rise of China. It's even more important for the sake of a peaceful world that the United States should find its proper place in a new world order. A declining superpower, losing both political and economic dominance, but still preserving military supremacy, is a dangerous mix. And as I've tried to show, democracy is in deep trouble in America. The financial crisis has inflicted hardship on a population that doesn't like to face harsh reality. President Obama has deployed the confidence multiplier and claims to have contained the recession. If there is a double dip, the population will become susceptible to all kinds of fear-mongering and populist demagogy. If President Obama fails, the next administration will be sorely tempted to create diversions from troubles at home, and that could be very dangerous for the world. President Obama has the right vision, but he needs to be more far-sighted. He believes in international cooperation rather than the Bush-Cheney idea of might is right. But he is preoccupied with many pressing problems. Reinventing the international financial system is not high on his agenda. Some of his economic advisors still seem to believe that the efficient market hypothesis is valid, except once in 100 years. The financial institutions that have survived are in a stronger competitive position than ever before, and they will resist a systemic overhaul that would curb their powers. What is lacking is a general recognition that the system is broken and needs to be reinvented. That's why it would be so important that the theory of financial markets I've outlined in these lectures should gain wider acceptance. The Chinese leadership would need to be even more far-sighted than President Obama. They are in the driver's seat, and if they moved towards a more open society, they would have to give up some of their privileges. Right now, the Chinese public is willing to subordinate individual freedom to political stability and economic advancement. But that may not continue indefinitely. Corruption is a big problem, and China needs the rule of law so that citizens can criticize the government and prevent it from abusing its powers. And China needs to become a more open society in order to be acceptable to the rest of the world. The rest of the world will never subordinate the freedom of the individual to the prosperity of the Chinese state. As China is becoming a world leader, it must learn to pay more attention to the opinion of the rest of the world. But all this may be happening too fast for the Chinese leadership to adjust to it. China is accustomed to thinking of itself as the victim of imperialism, so it doesn't realize that it's beginning to occupy an imperialistic position. That's why it has such difficulties in dealing with Africa and its own ethnic minorities. Hopefully, the Chinese leadership will rise to the occasion. It's no exaggeration to say that the future of the world depends on it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, George, for another masterful performance. I must say that I am honored and delighted to have been invited to chair this fifth and last lecture in the series. And maybe it's appropriate that the London School of Economics should come in at the end, as we came in at the beginning. And in his first lecture, George talked about his time at the LSE in the late 40s and some of the intellectual foundations of his current worldview, which arose from his interactions with Karl Popper at that time. Now, if you were an audience in London, you could see George Soros and me performing on stage every night of the week. Indeed, you could do so tonight. I see some slightly baffled faces. George knows what this means, in that there is, in fact, a play about the financial crisis on at the National Theatre, a very large play by a man called David Hare, in which both George and I are characters. And we have only ourselves to blame for this, because we talked to the author about the origins of the crisis, and all our own words on the crisis are used, but they are spoken by actors. And this, I think, and I'm sure George would agree, is a peculiar version of the problem he talked about in Lecture 4, which is the principal agent problem, in that we are the principals, but we have dramatic agents acting on our behalf. As it happens, I think George's agent is rather good. While mine, as my wife pointed out, is too ample and well padded. And all those hours I spend in the gym have gone to waste. But you are not here, invited me here, I think, as a drama critic, but rather to respond to some of the recommendations that George has made in his last lecture. First, should I say that I think he's absolutely right to emphasize that this crisis is quite unlike others we have been through, and that it does require a fundamental rethink of the way we oversee the world economy and regulate its financial markets. I happen to think also that he's right that the recovery is fragile and may well peter out in the next year or so, but I'm sure that George would accept that our views on that can be little more than hunches at this point. But I find it rather depressing that many commentators have now, after a period in which people were more ready to think fundamentally about whether efficient markets were an appropriate way of thinking about things and whether financial regulation was properly designed, that now many people have taken refuge in the positions they held before all this started. So we know that politicians on the left think it's all the fact, all the fault of too little regulation. The Wall Street Journal leader writers are absolutely convinced that it was all a problem of too much regulation. The French blame Anglo-Saxon capitalism. The Germans blame hedge funds. Gordon Brown in London says it was a crisis like Bruce Springsteen was born in the USA and nothing to do with us. No doubt in this part of the world too, the Austrians blame the Hungarians and the Hungarians blame the Austrians. But I think we have to do better, and I very much support George's general proposition that we do need to rethink some of the fundamental premises on which we have built the international monetary and regulatory system. Now, on regulation, and I used to be the financial regulator in the UK for 6 years and have therefore been a member of all of the international groups, the Basel Committee, and all of that. He is right to point out that the system is national and not global. And the fundamental point that global regulation as it is now conceived does not match the needs of global markets is correct. I think George might have gone on to add that there's another respect in which regulation is out of date, and that is that it's built on the three-pillar concept that there is banking, that there are securities, and that there is insurance, and never the three shall meet. And we know that some of the most toxic and dangerous elements of this crisis were precisely where these three interacted, so that AIG, which was regulated as an insurance company, was trading in the securities markets with banks and investment banks, and no one was looking at that picture in the round. So I agree with you, George, on that point, but I think you need to also look at the structure of the regulatory networks that we currently have. I also think it's important to distinguish the European problem from the broader global problem, and here I would have put the points a little differently. The key distinction in Europe, and this applies technically to the European Economic Area, not to the European Union, is that if you are a financial institution in Europe authorized in one place, whether it's Iceland or Latvia or London, then you can do what you like across the whole economic area. And there is no local purchase, if you like, by local regulators on those institutions. And that was the fundamental problem with Icelandic banks in the UK and in the Netherlands, and indeed with banks in Western Europe operating in Eastern Europe who withdrew their liquidity when the crisis was at its peak, and there was nothing that the local authorities could do about that. That flaw needs to be corrected. You can either dismantle the single financial market if you wish, but that would have other costs, or you need to produce some central authority to oversee these pan-European institutions. After Lisbon is agreed, and it looks after yesterday that that may well happen, it may be possible to make some progress. In my view, and this is perhaps a disloyal thing to say, the problem will turn out to be the United Kingdom and not Germany, because it's the UK that is currently resisting the establishment of central regulatory authorities in Europe. There is also, of course, as George pointed out, the broader issue of the structure of the Eurozone and the absence of a central fiscal or perhaps resolution authority, which will take a bit longer. But I think that it is possible to imagine a European resolution authority, at least for failing institutions, even if one can't get as far as a central fiscal authority with broader powers. Globally, I think the issues are a little different. Some things have been done, as George recognised. We've had G20 summits, and we have broadened the membership of the key international groupings. It was absurd in the past that over the last decade, the central organism that has been supposed to oversee global financial stability has been the Financial Stability Forum, as it then was. It's now become the Financial Stability Board. But that body excluded China, it excluded India, it excluded Brazil, for example. And so the big elephant in the room over the last decade of the emerging huge global imbalances, as we now call them, was one which could not be addressed in that forum. The key participants were not in the room. But there is, I think, in addition to the membership point, which is being addressed, a broader question, which is why it is that in the financial area, there is no world financial organization like the WTO. In trade, governments have recognized that it may be rational for them to concede some element of sovereignty to a global body on the basis that they all do gain by free trade, and there needs to be some policeman to ensure that people don't break the rules with impunity. It seems to me that we do all benefit from an interconnected global financial system, as long as it is appropriately regulated. But governments have not been prepared to make any concession to a global body in relation to the oversight of that system. The US has been the main resistor. The US indeed refused even the modest steps that were put in place after the Asian crisis, where the IMF was given the authority to assess people's regulatory systems. And the US was the one country that refused to allow an IMF inspection of its regulation on the basis that US financial regulation was obviously unimprovable. Now, they may now, I think, take a slightly different view, but the summits have so far failed to engage with this fundamental question of whether it is rational to consider the cession of some elements of financial sovereignty to a global body in the interests of ensuring that the system does not disintegrate, as I think it is at risk of doing, as George pointed out. I hope that one of the summits, or a grander Bretton Woods conference, as George recommends, will come to address that point. But at the moment, it's hard to be optimistic. Finally, before I open up to the audience, both in Hong Kong and here in Budapest, just a word on what George said about the role of China. I completely agree that one consequence of this crisis will be a further shift in the center of economic gravity to the east. For the students here who like this kind of thing, there are some French economists who have attempted to calculate precisely where the world's center of economic gravity is. I'm sure George knows, but I won't embarrass him by asking. But actually, it has moved. This is a calculation done by a least squares method, which is the point in the world which is least far away from where all the rest of economic activity is. And 15 years ago, it was just near Reykjavik. Eccentric, but if you think about it, and think of North America and Western Europe and China, you can see there's some rationality to that. And it has moved in the last 15 years from Reykjavik to Spitsbergen. So if you wish to be at the center of the world's economy, Spitsbergen is the place for your next holiday. But more seriously, I think we do have to recognize that shift, and we do have to engage, and also the Chinese rightly have to recognize that they are more important and that they can't just be in world fora passive and be just price takers, as it were, which I think has been their attitude so far. I'm privileged to be a member of the International Advisory Board of the Chinese Banking Regulator and the Securities Regulator as well, and I think that the policymakers there do recognize the risks they run from unbalanced growth. They recognize the risks they run from the way in which they have sought to stimulate their economy. The fiscal stimulus has gone largely through the banking system, and huge increases in bank lending have occurred, some of them in directed bank lending. And they do understand, I think, the risks that they run. As George says, the structure of their growth is intimately bound up with the nature of the political regime. I think the lesson the Chinese have sort of learned, although they don't say it quite explicitly, is that excessive reliance on export-led growth can be a vulnerability, can lead you into a position where your economy is vulnerable to events which you cannot control. But escaping from that growth model is difficult, and I think does involve integrating the Chinese much more closely into the world economic system so that they come fully to understand the true nature of their interdependence with the rest of us. Now, I'm sure that George's speech will have generated many thoughts and questions in your minds. And so what we're now going to do is, first of all, go to Hong Kong, where I know there are two or three questions certainly that will be asked. So I think we'll begin there. After that, We will come back and we will hear from Senator Buarque, who is on the front row, and then we will open it up to you. But let's go first to Hong Kong, where I believe someone is waiting, yes, indeed, on the screen I can see, to ask the first question. Thank you.
Greetings from the University of Hong Kong. We're honored to be with you today. And my name is Rusty Todd, and I teach business journalism here. The event at this end today was organized by the Journalism and Media Studies Center and the School of Economics and Finance. As you can tell, we've got a packed house. There are many faculty members here, but we're going to allow all three of our questions to come from our students, whom we're very proud of, and I will turn it over to them. Darcy, first question.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Mr. Soros. My name is Darcy. I come from mainland China, and I'm now in my year three, majoring in economics and finance. My question today is about China. You know, on one hand, China is growing as a more and more influential economy in the world, and many people say that Shanghai is going to be a new financial center in Asia. But on the other hand, the Chinese government is imposing a tight control over its economy and its financial markets to ensure its economic stability and privileges in international trade and etc. And this is, I think, it's certain to limit the growth of its financial markets. And so my question is, in your opinion, how would the Chinese government try to resolve such a paradox? And particularly for Shanghai, do you think that it would really become an international financial center or just a regional or domestic one? Thank you.
Thank you. George.
I think your question actually is more about Hong Kong than China. And I think your analysis is basically accurate. And I think that it means that Hong Kong will continue to play a very important role because of the international character of Hong Kong and the rule of law that actually prevails in Hong Kong and therefore facilitates international financial transactions. While Shanghai will undoubtedly grow in importance. I think that Hong Kong's role in the world, I think, is pretty well assured, provided the system hangs together.
Thank you. Can we have the second question from Hong Kong? Yeah.
My name is Natasha Khan, and I'm a Master's of Journalism student here at the University of Hong Kong. Mr. Soros, do you think that the Copenhagen talks will produce a global plan for dealing with climate change? And do you think the global financial system can come up with the huge amounts of money needed to pay for such a plan? Thank you.
It's a very good question. I'm afraid the chances of an international agreement of substance in Copenhagen are rather low, because while most countries now genuinely recognize that there is a very serious global problem, and I think the change in China's attitude is particularly impressive. I was in China in 2005, and then again I returned just last year. And the transformation in China's attitude is really quite remarkable. They realize that even though they are being pushed by the rest of the world, that they have internalized the need. They've seen the pictures of the Himalayan glaciers melting, and they already have a water problem in North China, and they realize that it's liable to then also affect South China. So China is definitely on board. But the approach taken in China is very different from the approach taken in Europe. And again, Europe is different from the United States. And therefore, while it may be possible to have some general global targets, unfortunately, it is, I think, almost impossible to have an international system that would establish an international price on carbon, which is, I think, really what is needed to bring the problem under control. Now, I think there is an opportunity to create some international fund, a very substantial international fund, for dealing globally, particularly in the field of forestry and agriculture, where the savings, the potential for savings, is actually the greatest. I didn't go into it in my speech, but actually the issue of SDRs provides that opportunity. And since the rich countries don't need the extra reserves, they could renounce the allocations, and it could be used for a global fund for taking care of protecting the forests in Brazil and in Indonesia and other places. And also to put up a fund for adaptation for those countries that are going to be most badly hurt and don't have the resources of their own, like Bangladesh and Africa. Now, the SDRs, of course, a very special kind of instrument, which there is a cost to using it. And that somebody has to pay that cost. And the gold reserves of the IMF have been designated to be used for the least developed, benefit of the least developed countries. So I think it could be used, the gold reserves could be used to pay the cost of the use of SDRs. And that's how an international fund could be financed. And I think this would be this is something that actually can be done. It is already done. This has happened on a small scale, and I think a fund of 100 billion could at least be put together, even in time for Copenhagen.
But do you think there's a problem of lack of American leadership on this, and just that Obama has had a recession to deal with? He's had the healthcare to deal with, he's got Afghanistan to deal with, and it's simply the issue doesn't seem to be getting the political attention in Washington.
No, you are absolutely right, and it's actually, it isn't President Obama's interest in the subject that stops it, stops America from taking the leadership. There is a particular law in America that specifically applies to the use of SDRs, the American SDRs. And so America, it requires the government to go to to Congress for authorization. They would need legislation. That is not the case in European countries. So actually, European countries could do it without America. It wouldn't cost them anything because the IMF would be paying for it. And this would be a great opportunity for Europe to take leadership. It's high time that Europe should show some area of leadership. Mm. And because America is handicapped, sort of more or less hands tied, this would be the time for Europe to take the leadership. And they are genuinely concerned. And, of course, America could come along. It would take them a little longer.
So that might be a job for the new European president, whoever that will turn out to be. Are you a candidate for that job? I think there'd be a lot of supporters. Let's have the third question from Hong Kong.
Hi, George.
My name is Yue Yang Lu, and I'm also from the Journalism and Media Studies Center. I studied journalism in the University of Hong Kong. And as you have been talking about the necessity and importance of international cooperation and global regulation in a new era, I would like to have your opinion on regional free trade agreements. Do you think they are helpful, or do you think they just get in the way of global progress?
Thank you. It's a very good question, and there is really no simple answer to it, because a regional agreements could be a handicap, or it could be a stepping stone. And I think a proper international structure would involve regional cooperation agreements as well as an international one. I think there is scope for both.
Thank you. We'll leave Hong Kong. We reserve the right to come back to you later if we have time to do that. But I'm now going to ask Senator Buarque from Brazil, who is on the front row. That's right, bring up the lights and wait for the microphone, who is going to...
Maybe come up here for a moment.
Sure. Can I do that? Sure.
I was asked to make an abstract of these 5 hours lectures in 5 minutes. And I hope I'll do. The way was to put the whole lectures together, choosing keywords. I chose 10 keywords of your speeches, and I put them together in groups of two. First is reflexivity. And manipulation. I'm living here, Mr. Soros, believing that there is an epistemological problem to understand reality, as you put, and reality is being manipulated by agencies and the agents. The second two words is bubbles and market fundamentalism. I'm believing that the bubbles, these silent atomic bombs of this time, they were created by the market fundamentalism. And we need some careful regulations. The third group of two words is private interests and common goods. I'm believing that private interest alone will not bring common goods. We need a lot of others, ideas, proposition, and even philanthropy to put private interest together with the common good. The fourth is open society and democracy. I'm living with the idea that democracy is necessary, but not enough to have an open society. We think, after the words of Mr. Soros, as I think I'm not speaking for you. This is my abstraction, my work. I think that we need moral values over even the power of majorities. The democracy alone will not work. And fifth, today we have two words: international cooperation or national dependence. American, Chinese, or even the G20 group against the whole of the world. We need to have international cooperation and not just some 1, 2, 3 countries putting their power. This is the abstract. Now I want to put, I have yet 2 minutes. I want to put some questions, not to answer today, just to keep think about that. One is from the philosophical point of view, not only to look for the epistemological problem of reflexivity, but also to the ontology of wealth. What is wealth? How to define correctly wealth? The other is how to put the national open societies in a planetary open civilization. Because the open society, each one of them is national. How to cope with migration, how to cope with ecology, how to cope with international unemployment, and all other planetary problems. And at least, I cannot avoid to say, Mr. Soros knows me, one time more, not for today, Mr. Soros, what is the role of education to change the world? I see no other way to substitute capitalism, socialism, but educationism. And Mr. Soros, I just want to say to you and to the director that personally, I thank you very much for these days. I hope you have energy to keep this kind of job you are doing now for many, many years. You have to take these speeches and lectures all over the world. And Mr. Rector, please take the Central European University as the platform to put Mr. Soros around the world. Thank you very much.
Do you want to answer?
Yeah, you should say something, yeah.
Thank you. Well, some huge questions there, George, which could require five more lectures to answer, I think. The ontology of wealth, a global open society, and the role of education. But do you want to pick up?
Well, I think it would require, actually, three lectures. They are very, very good questions. Wealth is it's an interesting thing. It reminds me of traveling in an Air France plane. The stewardess saw me looking at some charts, and she looked at it, and she said something to the effect that wealth is somehow connected with death. That it's not alive. That life is something else. I don't know. It's pretty profound. I thought at the time, and maybe I'll take a lecture to expand on that later. Of course, the role of civil society, I think, is an international civil society. It is very important, and I think it's going to be a driving force because, after all, democratic governments are, generally speaking, responsive to the demands of their population. And in that sense, I think China, while it's not a democratic country, is also what distinguishes it, that the leadership is responsive to the demands of the population. They are very, very sensitive to it. So I think that if there's a demand on the part of civil society for greater international cooperation, it will drive the leaders, the governments towards that. So I think it's a very, very important factor. It already is, and it ought to be more so. And the third thing was education. And of course, I think that, this reflexivity, while it's a very simple concept, that's probably why it's hasn't been recognized. It's too simple, it's too common sense. Nevertheless, it does make it more difficult to solve human problems. Because in trying to understand human affairs, you are shooting at a moving target. It's not something inert, but it's interactive, and your attempt to understand reality changes reality. And that makes it much more difficult. So I think education has to play a very important role in enabling us to deal with these rather complex human and political and social problems more effectively.
Thank you.
Now, the rest of you here have been all very patient so far, but now is your turn. Yes, and I see a hand here. Could you wait for the microphone to come to you, because particularly the people in Hong Kong won't hear? And give your name, that would be helpful. Thank you.
My name is Patrick Ladon, and, well, I'm just a regular Austrian banking supervisor, but still, I would like to ask a provocative question. Because as an Austrian, I know exactly which problem you address. Do you think that the most powerful men and women have not enough honor to give up a little bit of power to sustain freedom in future? That's my question. And last but not least, Austrians do not blame Hungarians. Austrians blame Germans. And we all know, Thomas Bernhard told us that sometimes they are not right.
Thank you.
Could you repeat it?
Well, the question is quite a philosophical question as to whether one of the fundamental problems we have is that people with power are unwilling to cede any of it, even if that would be in the interests of generating a more free society.
I entirely agree, and this was sort of very much at the heart of the agency problem that I was talking about. Because our political leaders are supposed to be serving the interests of the people who elected them, and yet they put their personal interests ahead of sometimes of the interests of the people who elected them, and they cling to power. In non-democratic states, that's a very big issue. Lifetime presidency, but in democratic countries too, the personal the egos of the leaders very often stand in the way of the common interest.
Somebody over there has caught my eye. Yes, if you could take a microphone down. The man sitting on the aisle there. Thank you. That's the one.
I'm Gabor Lipchai. I'm alumnus of the CEU Business School. Mr. Soros, do you think that there is a need for a world reserve currency as put forward by Mr. Robert Mundell, which might be a better tool towards creating a level playing field between the countries of the center and those of the periphery, as opposed to special adjoining rights which are subject to scrutiny and regulation?
Keynes was the first one who proposed the bancor as the as the international currency, but it was one step too far, and I'm afraid the proposal of an international currency is one step too far. However, the special drawing rights are a step in that direction, because special drawing rights are a combination of the national currencies which are adjusted according to the relative importance of the countries. So it's a composite of national currencies, and I think it is actually a desirable reform to move in that direction. It's an extremely complex structure. It can be simplified, but also it would be further complicated by the admission of additional currencies, because I think right now it's composed of the dollar, the euro, sterling, and the yen. And I think it to be really representative, it would certainly have to include the renminbi and the real, and maybe a few other currencies to make it really more appropriate. But I'm very much in favor of that, and I think it is also in the interest of the United States now to move in that direction.
When you your ideas for a Bretton Woods that would look at all of this, I mean, how much political interest do you think there is in that in the U.S. and in Europe? You know, when you meet political leaders, do you get a kind of complete rejection, or do you think there is some interest?
Well, no, I'm afraid I don't see the interest among the leaders. So that's another area where I think a popular demand would be needed to get you there. And I think in particular for the United States, since we have had a great deal of benefit from it in the past, but some of that turned out to be illusory because basically it allowed us to, the United States, to build up a chronic current account deficit, which reached 6.5% of the GDP at the end of a 25-year build-up, and that made everybody. It enabled America to spend 6.5% more than it earned. So it felt very good, but now there is a very, very heavy price to pay, and that should be enough to tell us that we really ought to do without it. That we would be better off not for the dollar not to play that role, because it's built into the system that if you have, if the dollar is the international currency, and if the world economy grows, you need more dollars. And where can the dollars come from? Only from the issuing country. Mm. So it builds the deficit into the system, and it's not good. So I think it would be in our interest to move away from it.
I think I saw another hand, yeah, just quite near where the last one was. Thank you.
Hello, Ms. Soros. My name is Paula Korb. I am French, and I'm a faculty member of the CU Business School. My question is the following. In the past, there has been a huge trade deficit of the U.S. with East Asia, so this deficit has not changed much. It's just shifted from Hong Kong, Taiwan to China now due to the labor change. Why this deficit in the past has not caused such huge trouble but will cause such huge change in the future? Thank you.
The question is that why that the U.S. has been running a large trade deficit with East Asia for a long time. It used to be primarily with places like Taiwan and Hong Kong, it then shifted to the mainland. Why is it that in the past it didn't cause such instability and trouble, and more recently it has done?
Well, it took 25 years for it to build up. It really started in the 80s with what I called Reagan's imperial circle. And it has just continued to build up. And actually, it, as I said in my presentation, it could have continued almost indefinitely because there were a willing lender and willing borrower. The United States was happy to spend more than it earned, and there were countries in Asia that were very happy to build up their wealth and build up their savings that way. So there was a symbiosis, a symbiotic relationship. It would have continued. And actually, it is still continuing now because of the big stimulus applied in the United States. The deficit is still very large, and China is still building up its surplus. So actually, we haven't yet started correcting it. So it's really the housing bubble and what happened to the consumers and to the banking system that has brought this thing to an end.
It's a combination of the trade surplus and the domestic bubbles.
Yeah, it was the domestic bubble, the housing bubble that became unsustainable.
Yeah.
Not the deficit that could have continued, as I say, for indefinitely.
Now, I'm at the LSE. I get into huge trouble if I don't take as many women questions as I take men. But I'm struggling because I can't see any women who want to ask a question. So I shall pick on one of you soon if you don't. But there was somebody over here, I think. Didn't I see a hand there? Yes, there's one there. Yes, that's the one. Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Soros.
Yes, a bearded woman.
Not a lady, but hope,
do your best.
Nice enough. Mr. Soros, my name is Omer Dar. I'm coming from Israel, and I'm a student of the CU, in the CU. My question is more regarding your previous lectures. You mentioned terms such as seeking for the truth, avoiding manipulation. You also mentioned that the regulator should be the one to put the regulation on markets. But you also mentioned that investors are profit-oriented, and this was acceptable by you. After this crisis, don't you think that investors, especially the big players in the markets, should have an ethical responsibility rather than just going after the profit? Thank you.
Shouldn't investors have more of an ethical responsibility rather than simply profit-seeking motivation?
Well, as I said in my lecture, and I maintain that position, that as an investor in the financial markets, you have, and if the markets are truly efficient with many participants, then the influence of an individual investor is minimal. It's at the very margin. And therefore, you really are not responsible for the outcome. Now, you can organize, for instance, investors to act as a group, as was done in the case of South Africa. And it was actually quite successful in bringing pressure on Africa. So there are areas where investors could act as a group, form a group, and have an influence on legislation. Actually, some of the legislation with regard to extractive industries is relying on this kind of pressure. But in the normal course of events, this is not where the investors, individual investors, can influence the outcome. And it's where they can influence it, which is in legislation and in making of the rules. That's where they ought to put ethical considerations ahead of their personal interests.
Thank you. Now, I do have a woman question over here, second row, and then I see someone behind as well. So, woman on the second row, that there, yeah, first.
Sure,
yeah,
list.
And then
okay.
You. I've got you.
No. Okay. Well, you got the woman. I'm from a very strange country with a different economic pattern as Argentina. That has not been mentioned much here, but I would like to hear more. My question, I'm a PhD student in CU, first. My question goes more towards a summary of what has been discussed in here. And lately, this concept of social responsibility. I mean, I would like to know how this concept fits into the theory of reflexivity that Mr. Scholz has been exposed here. And if there is certain kind of a scope in this concept for generating these changes that he's looking for in agency and agents, I think that might be a chance in there. But I would like to know what is your opinion.
Thank you. A student from Argentina, which hasn't been mentioned, interested in how the concept of social responsibility can be built into reflexivity and whether that can help resolve some of the problems if people, market participants, had more sense of social responsibility. I guess it's a cousin of the question we've just had.
Yeah, I don't immediately respond to the question. I don't know how it could be used. If you have any suggestions, I'd be interested. I don't connect immediately this.
I mean, are you suggesting that? I mean, one of the things people sometimes argue is that if you impose duties on corporations, on corporate social responsibility, etc., you could do the same thing with investors. Is that the kind of argument that you're suggesting?
Well, it's a sort of combination of everything, because Senator Warki was very concerned with this education, and we address also a question in this discussion. I think the third session, the answer of Mr. Shores was that one solution to the lack of answers we have, solving crisis and the commitment of these agents in the international market, let's say, connecting people through education and spreading this reflexivity theory of, by education. So I was thinking that social responsibility can be a tool for solving the problem of agency and agents he's founding in his evaluation of how the market is operating. And moreover, I think that this education goal he has also can be spread by this concept of social responsibility. So I always felt that there is a need of discussing the discussion that we are having here, not with this target of people, but those who actually are active participants of the market. So I always went back home, let's say, saying, okay, but I shouldn't be the one I've been addressed, but someone else here needs to be addressed. Mm. So, and I think that the concept of social responsibility can be a good nexus. I mean,
thank you. Yes, the notion is that, I mean, it's partly linked to what Senator Buarque was saying about the need for education and to educate people to understand the way they are acting and your reflexivity, but that... And her observation is that we shouldn't really be talking to students at the CEU, we should be talking to financial market participants. And how do you, therefore, you get your ideas across to them and make financial market participants understand the broader framework within which they're operating and their social responsibility?
Look, I think the same thing applies to financial market participants as to other citizens. Namely, when it comes to the making of the rules, and clearly you are in great need of financial reform, they should not be lobbying for their private interests, their special interests. And it is happening right now in the United States, where, for instance, the legislation on reform is running into very serious opposition from the local banks, because there are quite a few abuses in the use of credit cards. It's really quite a shocking situation how credit cards have been used to exploit, in a way, a vulnerable segment of the population, vulnerable in the sense that they became indebted. Yes. They became users of credit cards, and that made them vulnerable. And if you look at the kind of charges that are levied, they are really quite excessive. But the banks are defending it and refusing to allow a consumer protection agency that would deal with that. And that is, I think, reprehensible. But I think the same applies to other industries as well.
Okay. Now, I've got one more question over there, and then, but I will take a question from Hong Kong after that, if you have one. And since I've just had a woman, it doesn't have to be a woman, nor does it have to be a man with a beard. It could be anybody. So, Matt, next one over here.
My name is Laszlo Wawra, and let me ask you here from the very background of this Nice hall, Mr. Soros, pronouncing your name in Hungarian here in Budapest. I would have two questions. The question number one is the topic you lectured yesterday and before yesterday. And I would like to ask you whether in your reflexive open society, in your mind, is it a deterministic world or a kind of stochastic world? The question is reasonable because totally different vehicles and methods are necessary in order to avoid contradictions. And I suppose that you, as an inventor of a new system, let's say, you try to achieve a contradiction-free system, or at least a system where the number of contradictions are as less as possible. So in your mind, is it a deterministic or a stochastic world? And question number two
Let's stick to one.
Is your world of reflexivity a deterministic world or a stochastic world?
It's a world of trial and error, definitely not deterministic.
Okay. So your second one?
Okay, so the second question is about the regulation you mentioned in your today lecture. After the big crash in 1929, the U.S. House of Representatives issued a so-called Glass-Steagall Act, which tried to make a significant difference between very risky and less risky products in the financial sector. In your mind, is your proposition something very similar to it? Because so far I know this act, the Glass-Steagall Act, had been ignored at the end of the second period of the Clinton administration. Thank you.
It's a question about Glass-Steagall. Is what you're proposing effectively a reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall division?
This is an open question. Whether you need to go back there. I would look for a solution short of a return to Glass-Steagall. I think it's first of all, it had its own shortcomings. Mm. For instance, the fact that the banking system was strictly confined to individual states. It actually increased the risks of banks.
Concentration risk,
particularly dependent on agriculture, yes. For instance, and so on. So it wasn't an ideal system at all. But I do think that you have to have internal separations of capital, not only between commercial banking and investment banking, but investment banking participation in specific markets, because you need to break or reduce contagion going from one market, yeah, to another. The abolition of these segmentation resulted in contagion, both internationally and within markets. And the collapse of the subprime market then cascaded remarkably fast to all kinds of other markets, some of whose existence I wasn't even, yes, aware of, like municipal bonds.
Auction rate securities.
Auction rate.
That's one I discovered too.
Yes, there were markets we didn't know about, yeah, that collapsed and hurt the rest of the market. So you do need to compartmentalize. And I use the analogy to oil tankers, where you build buffers so that the oil can't slosh around, because otherwise...
Yes.
And I had the pleasure of flying on an airplane, Russian Tupolev, carrying gas pipes to Bosnia to Sarajevo, and the crew had to constantly readjust the target so that we didn't roll over. So that's a good example.
Good analogy. Now, I know it's getting late in Hong Kong, but do we have another question from Hong Kong? Yes? Good.
Mr. Soros, greetings from Hong Kong. You mentioned earlier about the gap between investors' sentiment and the reality. But Australia has recovered, China has recovered, and America has also, you know, seems to have recovered. So where do you identify as the gap between the mood and the reality? And there is a widespread fear of inflation because of the huge injection of government money into the economy. But do you think this is a misconception by itself, because the money will eventually be withdrawn from the market? Thank you.
He points out that a number of countries are already recovering, including now the United States. And so he's really asking where you see the areas of concern still are. But also, secondly, the second question is whether all this liquidity that's been injected in the system is likely to result in a resurgence of inflation.
Yeah, well, the two are connected in a way, because the recovery has been brought about by the unprecedented use of financial and fiscal stimulus. The problem is that certainly in the United States, I think you will continue to need additional injections of stimulus to keep the economy going, because the recovery is very much the result of that stimulus being applied. And you haven't yet reduced the percentage of consumption as a percentage of the GNP. In the United States, it was up to 70%, which is too high, and it's got to drop to low 60s. And it has dropped, of course, but at least part of the half the drop is due to transfer payments, which came out of the stimulus. Mm. So that's the problem that's confronting the world, which may not be fully recognized. Then, of course, the other side is that with all this injection of liquidity, as private lending or bank lending is restarted, from deflation you could flip over into inflation. And so, because you are facing this very complicated two-step maneuver, I mean, the global economy, and particularly the American economy, was very far from equilibrium. And when you have this kind of far from equilibrium situation, to correct it, first you have to, when you're skidding, you have to turn the wheel the same way as the car is skidding, and then you have to correct it. So it's a two-step maneuver. Mm. And of course, how to execute a second step is the big problem ahead of us.
Yeah. I've got another one there, a man in a blue shirt.
Thanks for coming, Mr. Soros. My name is Chris Nicholson. I'm an American student in the one-year MBA program. And we're talking about a lot of increased responsibilities in a way for our political leaders and maybe our corporate board members. And so I'm curious whether you think we have the incentives in place right now to attract the top people that we want to occupy those roles, you know, in light of the burdens and risks that they take in pursuing them at the same time.
Both politicians and board members, you're
correct.
Thinking.
Yeah, correct.
That's the last part of the question.
Yeah, the question is whether we have, given all of the burdens and responsibilities on both politicians trying to manage the system, but also board members, whether the incentives and rewards are right to attract people into those key jobs, whether as political oversight or as board of directors' oversight?
Well, I think it is actually very largely an ethical problem. Incentives alone are—I mean, I presume that you're referring to the extra responsibility that now affects board members under the new legislation. I think that it is actually very largely an ethical problem that the people in charge have to act in a way that they don't transgress the law. If it's purely incentives, it was not enough to stop from companies doing things that they ought not to be doing, like not disclosing information correctly. And I think that it would also involve that people who take on the responsibility would also have more respect for the work that they are doing.
Now, I think we're running quite up against time. I saw two more, and I'm going to take them together. Yes, these two, and then we'll make those the last questions. Man in black first, and then you.
Okay, so thank you. I'm Stefan Cibian, PhD candidate at Central European University. My question refers to ordinary people. You've mentioned today the importance of civil society, and at the end of the lecture yesterday, you mentioned that people are the most important in the system. However, most of the discussion centered rather on governments, markets, and elites. So I was wondering, first of all, what is the role of ordinary people in this framework? Second of all, you mentioned the increasing manipulation that we have in the relationship between governments and ordinary people, citizens, let's say. Now, if this manipulation has increased and it affects somehow the basis of the system, it means that we are somehow in problem because the basis of the system is no longer capable of performing its role. So my question here would be, how can the ordinary people regain their significance, their meaning in the system that we have? Thank you.
Thank you. And then we'll take this other one here. Man in a... Yeah, if we can get the microphone back. Red shirt. Right. That's it.
Okay. Sir? Yeah. In fact, I have no question. I'd like just to speak for a lady. I'm not a lady. But I'd like to speak for my daughter. My name is Gheorghe Moroșanu. Or George, if you wish. I'm proud to have a similar name. I am a professor of mathematics at the Central European University. Well, first I'd like to thank George for your great lectures. Second, maybe you may remember 2 years ago I offered you one of my books. In fact, that book was dedicated to you, George, because I consider, you are a great supporter of mathematics, among many other things. And now I'd like to offer another book. Don't worry, it's not my book. In fact, it's your, it is a Romanian translation of your book about fallibility. The translation, it turns out that the translation belongs to my daughter, Laura. She is not in Budapest at the moment. She is in Bristol, United Kingdom, and she asked me to offer you this book. This is a strong evidence that your ideas are very much appreciated everywhere in the world, including Romania. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's a book that is one of your books translated into Romanian by his daughter.
Very nice.
Who is currently in Bristol, but here it comes. Yeah. There you are.
Good, thank you.
And then the previous question was really, what happened to the people? You talk about the problem of democracy, and particularly the problem of manipulation of people your reflexivity theory being based on the notion that some of what people are doing is deliberately manipulative. what should people be doing, ordinary people be doing, in the light of the fact that they are being manipulated, if you see what I mean? What is the role for the people?
No, I think it's the ordinary people have a very big role. They must actually punish those who lie to them, particularly if it's deliberate deception. They have the vote, and they should exercise it in that way. And that would discourage that kind of deliberate manipulation. I think they are the ultimate judge. And if they exercise good judgment, we will have a well-functioning democracy.
Thank you. I think we ran past our scheduled time, but we ran our 2 hours. So on my behalf, I know that John's going to deliver a final thanks, but could I thank the audience both here and in Hong Kong for making my job easy with lots of good questions. And I'll then hand... I just want one personal comment, is that all my life I've been trying to find the secret of how to chat up Air France air hostesses. And it's a bit late, but I now have discovered I need a few charts and graphs. And that's the secret. And that may be very useful to some of the men out there. Thank you.
Well, I think Howard Davies has summed it up very well. You can see how many tips have been acquired during the course of this week. All kinds, in the market, in the Air France, all sorts of things. We have really had an extraordinary week, I'm sure you would all agree. We've been inspired, provoked, and challenged by our masterful and eloquent lecturer. And he, in turn, has been prodded and pushed and praised by our global audience in Budapest, in London, in Cambridge, in New York, in Shanghai, in Hong Kong today. And I think we'd all agree that we've come through far wiser, perhaps, than we were on Monday morning. There are many subjects that have been covered. Howard Davies even took us into the theater today, which I found rather an interesting diversion when he told us that he and George Soros are not only starring here on the stage in the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, but also on the London stage. And I would only add the obvious, which is that George Soros is starring on the world stage. And these lectures are the latest and in many ways the greatest of his many performances. And let me respond to Senator Buarque's challenge and say that we at CEU regard George Soros as our most distinguished lecturer and invite you, George, to continue to be our global superstar. I want to thank our overflow audience of students in Hong Kong, a wonderful visual image that many of you have seen, and thank you for your questions, and our lively audience here in Budapest, our distinguished moderator, Howard Davies, our thoughtful commentator, Krista von Buarque, and above all, let me ask you to join me in saluting our superstar for his extraordinary performance throughout this week. Thank you.